Well, hello everybody, and welcome back for part two of our evening. I'm going to be talking now about the five hindrances. And I want to thank Jerry for thank you for that great talk, giving us a good overview of these three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. And I think we have a pretty good idea of what these mind states are like from that talk, those states we so easily get caught up in and that cause us so much pain. Now, the five hindrances that I'll be talking about now are some of the typical ways in which those three poisons play out in our meditation practice and our life. So they're just a little bit more specific examples of how hatred, greed, and delusion can show up. And these five hindrances are craving, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and doubt. But before I talk about the specific hindrances, one of the things I'd like to say, and I think Jerry also talked about this point, is it's important to realize that when these mind states appear, that doesn't mean that you're doing something wrong or that you're a bad person or anything like that. These are like temporary visitors to the mind and kind of instinctive reactions that we have as humans when we experience things that are pleasant or unpleasant, or maybe that aren't really either. We just tend to do that. You know, if something is pleasant, we try to grab on. If something's unpleasant, we push it away. And if something is neutral, we get bored or restless or go to sleep. So the point is that we don't need to try to fight so much and get rid of these mind states, because if we do that, we're not going to have a lot of success anyway. In fact, when we try really hard to get rid of them, sometimes they get even stronger. But instead, to really understand them, to learn to work with them skillfully, so that when they come up, as they will, we understand them well enough so that we don't let them control our behavior and our thinking in ways that will really cause a lot of problems and suffering for ourselves and for others. So remembering, you know, not to blame yourselves when they come, but use them as an opportunity to really learn and understand more about these mind states. So on to the individual hindrances. Now, first there is craving, which Jerry already talked about quite a bit with greed, that craving for pleasant experiences, for things that we think will bring us happiness. And as Jerry said, and I think you all know, this can range from, you know, just a fierce obsession to just kind of a subtle feeling that, oh, it wouldn't be nice if I had this or that, which doesn't even seem to deserve the name craving, but still, it's enough to make you feel a little bit restless, a little bit discontented, not really able to be with what is. And craving can be kind of a challenging hindrance because we don't necessarily always recognize it as something that's painful or even as a problem. You know, all too often we get so absorbed in our craving and caught in all the fantasies about the things that we want and that we think will bring us so much pleasure if we just get them, you know, that we're totally caught in our illusion and our delusion, this feeling that, oh, if I just get this, I'll finally be happy. And as long as we're caught up in the fantasies, craving even feels pleasant. But then, of course, when it becomes clear that this fantasy isn't going to come true and we aren't going to get what we want, well, then we know how painful craving really is. So in working with this hindrance, there are some various things we can do, and some of this Jerry already mentioned, which is first to just actually recognize that experience of craving itself. And so, you know, see if you can make the effort to separate that object of craving and these fantasies about it from the actual feeling of craving. You know, really feel what wanting is instead of just getting lost. And I think when you do that, you really can sort of feel like when craving is there, there's a kind of a sense of lack, of not being satisfied, maybe of restlessness and longing. And none of these are very pleasant emotions. Craving really in itself is not very pleasant. And so when we really feel it and investigate in it this way, we come to understand more about the second noble truth, then we can really kind of see for ourselves that the cause of dukkha is this craving. And then it's good also to bring wisdom into this, as Jerry was mentioning too. You know, recognizing that this thing that you want, well, you know, it might be nice and pleasant for a while. It's not going to bring you this endless and lasting pleasure that your fantasy might tell you it will. It's not going to last forever. It's going to change. And also, and I think this is important too, is to recognize that as long as you're caught up in some form of craving and always looking into the future for that thing that's going to be better, you can't really experience or appreciate what's occurring in the present. And that can be a big loss in terms of your richness of your life, but also a real hindrance to your practice. Because if we can't actually see what's occurring in the present, we're not really seeing clearly. It's really hard to practice. So when a pleasant experience arises, you know, rather than getting caught in this sense of, oh, if I could just have this forever, see if you can bring more appreciation and gratitude to that experience, rather than getting caught up in the delusion that somehow you have to have this thing forever. And then there's aversion. Kind of a flip side of craving, not wanting, not liking. Maybe you could even call it a craving for whatever is going on to end or to just not be there. So I think in contrast to craving, I think we all would pretty much agree that aversion is not a real pleasant mind state. It isn't fun when we're just hating whatever is going on, not liking and not wanting what is happening to us. And just like craving too, it's accompanied by delusion. And, you know, one of the big ones is this feeling that, oh, this shouldn't be happening. And when we learn about the first noble truth, we learn that some painful experience is just part of human life. And I think really we know this for our own experience. Painful and difficult things happen. Not because we've necessarily done, sometimes we've done something to bring it about, other times it just occurs. But when we're caught in this aversion, we don't really accept that. And so we might quickly start forming all kinds of strategies for getting rid of the thing we don't like, or looking for someone or something to be angry at, somebody to blame because this is happening. You know, maybe it's somebody else. Sometimes it's ourselves too. And then we get caught in self-criticism and hatred and depression. And I think we also tend to feel when we're in a difficult situation in all our frustration and confusion that this is never going to end. This unpleasant thing is going to go on forever. Which of course it won't. It's going to change. Everything changes. But at the time we can't really feel that. So working with aversion is kind of similar to working with craving in that it's helpful to separate the object of your aversion from the feeling of aversion itself. So actually turning your mind toward what it feels like to not want, to be averse. and feeling the way it is in your mind and in your body. And I think one of the really helpful and kind of funny things about this is sometimes you will find that the mental reaction of aversion is actually a lot more unpleasant than that mild disturbance that triggered it in the first place. You know, you might find that, say, you're sitting and you have just a little bit of a discomfort in your back or your leg, or maybe it's a little bit too warm or too cold. And the aversion can just blow up into this big thing in your mind that is much more painful than this minor discomfort. So that sort of helps to kind of release it a little bit. And then it also, I think it's good to offer yourself some compassion for the pain that you're in. And of course, you know, if you can relieve the pain by doing practical and appropriate things, then you can do them. For example, if you're sitting with body pain, stay with it, investigate it for a while, get a sense of it, what it is like and what's going on in your mind, but when it becomes too much, you can shift your position. And then bringing wisdom too, you know, recognizing that that painful experience is part of life. It isn't necessarily your fault. It isn't necessarily somebody else's fault. We all have painful and pleasant and neutral experience. And as well, recognizing that while the situation might be difficult right now, it isn't going to last forever. All things arise and pass away, both pleasant and unpleasant experience. And if we can, you know, do some of these things, bring some of this wisdom to this situation, maybe we can just, instead of getting caught up in the aversion, just rest back in the unpleasantness itself. And so then we feel the unpleasantness, but we don't have to feel that second extra suffering, mental suffering of the aversion. Now we come to sloth and torpor. And this is kind of an interesting hindrance. I mean, sometimes this is just plain old sleepiness. You know, if we've been going and going and going and doing and doing and doing and we haven't gotten enough rest, then when we finally sit down and are quiet, whoof, we fall asleep. And it can also be associated sometimes with an imbalance in energy during meditation. You know, like maybe if we're really focusing on the sensations of the breath and we feel a lot of concentration and tranquility, we may get kind of dull because we don't have enough energy in investigation. We sort of zone out into that tranquility. And these are things that are pretty easily dealt with. But sloth and torpor can also arise under other conditions. You know, sometimes it can come up as a way of protecting ourselves when we're getting close to something that might be kind of scary or challenging. We sort of kind of zone out or fall asleep, or maybe a memory that's very, or a deeply rooted tendency we don't want to look at. Sometimes it comes up then. Or maybe it comes up when we're confused and full of doubt and we don't think we're up to the task at hand. When we look at the five spiritual faculties, which I think we're going to cover in one of the classes that's coming up, one of the first ones is faith, and it's a precursor to energy. And so it makes sense that if we don't have a lot of faith in ourselves or in what we're doing, we're not going to have a lot of energy. You know, we'll feel dull and sluggish and lacking in enthusiasm because we kind of feel like, well, we can't do this anyway. So depending on what's actually going on, there are different ways to work with sloth and torpor. So when it comes up, it's good to get a sense of, you know, what's actually happening with you, what's behind it. Is it just sleepiness because you're tired or your energy is out of balance or maybe something else going on? When it arises, During meditation, there are simple things you can do, you know, opening your eyes or standing up. Sometimes it can help to actually bring more attention to the feelings that are coming and going in your body as sleepiness descends. And that energy of investigation will help to dispel the sleepiness. That doesn't always work. I mean, you have to have a certain level of mindfulness to do that, or you'll just fall asleep. But when it does, it can be pretty interesting. And it's also said that the Buddha used to pull his earlobes when he got sleepy, and that's why they're so long in some of those statues. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but you could try it. And, you know, like on a retreat or something like that, doing more walking and less sitting can help to balance your energy. And, of course, if you're really tired and sleepy, getting the rest you need. But it's also worthwhile to take some time to explore what might be behind the sloth and torpor if you think that it might be more than just sleepiness. If there's a sense of a lack of energy, a lack of enthusiasm, maybe there's some underlying fear or doubt. So you might want to look at that too. Then there's restlessness and worry. And this is a hindrance that I think sometimes it doesn't get enough attention. At least I know in my own training, when I was first learning to meditate, it was usually presented more as a feeling of restlessness in the body. You know, this sort of feeling that you can't sit still. But I think restlessness in the mind might be even more common, and that deserves attention too. And in a way, I think maybe this restlessness might be something that's becoming more and more prevalent in our society now, because we have so much stimulation and so many distractions. And, you know, there's information coming at us everywhere. We can always take in information from our devices. We're multitasking, doing so much at once. You know, maybe we're working on a report at work, but stopping every few minutes to check our email or our phone messages, or music is playing in the background where we're doing something else, or the TV is on. You all know what that picture is. And we're so used to stimulation and information and entertainment nonstop, that when we sit down to meditate, our minds are just naturally restless, distracted, full of all kinds of weird stuff, and we feel this. So this mental restlessness is there, and it can be reflected in physical restlessness. Or we might have physical restlessness in sitting because we have some kind of expectation that we ought to be able to be completely relaxed, completely comfortable. And so every time that this doesn't conform to our ideals, we feel like we need to move, we need to adjust, we need to do this, we need to do that. That can cause restlessness too. And then there is worry. You know, when one form of worry that's mentioned in the teachings is this worry of remorse, where we're worrying about things we've done in the past that we regret, or maybe we're afraid that others might find out about and, you know, not think very well of ourselves. But worry can take other forms too, you know, a sort of obsessive worrying about our families or our work or politics or whatever it is, you know, that kind of worry that sometimes we do because we feel like if we're worrying, then at least we're doing something or we're demonstrating that we care about something. You know, it sort of, even though it doesn't really help, we feel somehow like we're doing something. And then there's just plain anxiety, sometimes that kind of free-floating anxiety where we're not even sure what we're anxious about. So how can we work with this hindrance? Pervasive, but not emphasized so much. Well, I think one thing that may be helpful is to just accept the fact that our modern life encourages mental distraction. And so it's likely we will have some mental restlessness when we first sit down to meditate. So, you know, Focus on your breath, on the body, be patient. You know, allow the mind some time to settle without feeling like something is wrong. And maybe doing what you can in your daily life to avoid too much multitasking and too much information coming in, you know. Kind of sort of keep the information overload and distraction to a reasonable level, you know, what we need to know and what we need to do, but not overwhelming ourselves. If physical restlessness is a problem, you know, maybe seeing if you have expectations of perfection that you're not going to find, or maybe just kind of an energy imbalance. Maybe it would be good for you to do more moving meditation, walking, qigong, something like that, if it's difficult and you get restless when you're sitting. I mean, those are good alternatives. For restlessness and remorse, it definitely helps to do some forgiveness practice for yourself and also letting the precepts be a support. So, you know, if we avoid situations where we're likely to get into trouble, refrain from actions we'll later regret, this really goes a long way towards peace of mind. With anxiety and worry, I might first say there's no doubt that we have a lot to be anxious about with all the things we've been going through in these last few years. So if you suffer from that, you're not alone. And I think having a sense of the instability of life does bring about anxiety. But it can be too, you know, that they're deep habit patterns. One thing that can be helpful to recognize, I think, is that all this worry and anxiety, it's a sort of a futuring where we're predicting a bad outcome. But has this actually happened? No. It's in your imagination. You don't know if it will happen or not. So recognizing that, and if there are repetitive worries, maybe taking some time to see what kind of stories you're telling yourself and then ask whether this situation is really true or really likely. Is this helpful, all this worry? You know, doing some exploration like that, and then letting your attention return to what's actually happening now rather than these projected worries for the future. And it can be also helpful to just let all of the stories go and just feel the anxiety in your body, and recognizing that it will arise and pass. And this helps you to see this is a temporary visitor. And I'd better hurry to get through with this talk so we have time for everything. But five hindrances, it's a lot. So finally, there's the hindrance of doubt. And this can be really difficult and destabilizing and also hard to recognize. And first, I want to say there's a difference between healthy doubt and not knowing and the hindrance of doubt. And Gil Fronsdale, who is a long established Vipassana teacher who teaches down in California, he talks about these two as questioning doubt versus hindering doubt. And questioning doubt is when we just don't know or understand something. And in that situation, we can talk to our teachers, we can read, we can practice and find out things. And this kind of doubt really isn't a problem. It's just something that we need to investigate further that we don't know about. But the hindering doubt is more of, Gil Fronsdale defines it as a mental preoccupation with indecision, uncertainty, and lack of confidence that's directly related to our practice itself. And it can be a pretty serious hindrance because if it's strong enough, we might give up our practice altogether. Now, this hindering doubt can involve doubt about practice, about the teachings, about one's teachers, but I think most commonly, really, at the base, it's a feeling of doubt about oneself, that feeling of, I don't think I can do this, I don't think I really want to do this. We all have had that kind of feeling, say, when we go on a retreat or start a class, and just before it, we have this sort of, do I really want to do this? Do I really want to do this? But these kind of things can be more deep-seated, you know, like we can have fears about where the practice is heading as we begin to get more of a sense of impermanence or this sense of not self. Resistance can come up because some of these things are a little bit scary. And it can be hard to recognize this hindrance of doubt because there's so much delusion and confusion. And rather than thinking, oh, this is a hindrance of doubt, we think, oh, this is a problem with me and my practice, and I have to figure out how to solve it. So we get all caught up in that. So I think with this doubt, I mean, the first thing is really to recognize here is this hindering doubt, this feeling of indecision, willingness to commit, feelings of inadequacy. Maybe it shows up as suddenly wanting to find fault with the teachers or something like that, when really it's sort of your own lack of confidence. Noticing how it feels in the body, what this mental state is like. If there's something you actually can ask questions about, do it. Although that might not be what the problem really is. And I think it can also be helpful when we're caught in doubt to bring our practice back to a place where it's really simple. Just remember the basic instructions. Be present with what's occurring in the present moment as much as you can. You know, you don't have to have some lofty goal or make anything happen, just be there. And if you're just there for what's happening, there isn't a lot to have doubt about. It's just what is, you know, so that can help. And I think the doubt often comes up when we're so caught up in trying to do our practice and make progress. And if we realize we don't really have to do that, we'll be less caught in doubt. And it can also be helpful just to notice that tendency of getting caught up in self-doubt in other areas of your life, if this is a sort of a habit pattern. So, you know, recognizing that this is a difficult hindrance, and sometimes it arises in response to some of our instinctive ways of seeing things, deep-seated fears, all things our practice tends to stir up and expose. I mean, even the Buddha had to deal with doubt, with Mara asking him, "What right do you have to think you can do this, to look for enlightenment?" So if the Buddha himself had to deal with this, you're in really good company. So treat yourself to some compassion and patience when doubt arises. So I'll stop there with our discussion of the five hindrances. Lots to think about, lots to work with. Maybe sit for just one moment to kind of quiet our minds.